They're constantly having people fuck with their sound or style or image or songs. But we kind of set it up from day one not to ever have to deal with that. Asif Ahmed. They were adamant about staying on Touch and Go in Wichita, where they'd done their EPs. The band didn't even want a major label logo on the fucking CD case. Sarush Alvi. There was still an aversion to majors at that time. Asif Ahmed. Every band cares about image. If you find one that says they don't, they're fucking lying. Some bands want that legacy to say, we were good enough to be signed to a major. But Yeah Yeah Yeahs didn't care. The indie thing was important to them because of the lack of pressure. They knew they were good. Karen knew she was good. She just didn't want to say it. No one wanted to say it, because that's when the kind of weird postmodernist pre-Pitchfork era of whatevs kicked in. It's cooler to be, meh.
Kim Gordon. When Yeah Yeah Yeahs signed, Karen asked me about Interscope. At that point, we were so over the major label thing. We were like, you can do it if you want, if that's what you want. What do you want? A lot of people who want major label deals don't realize how much work is involved. They expect you to work a lot.
Nick Zinner. I remember Karen saying, we are serious people in an unserious band. I try to stand by that. To not get too precious about things. To not have every little decision be the end-all and be-all of your entire personality. Asif Ahmed. The turning point was when then they get their first royalty statement back from Wichita. $32. I called them and I was laughing so hard. They were like, why are you laughing? I'm like, it's for $32! They started laughing too. Karen was like, okay, we'll call you back. Maybe 2 hours later, she called me. She wasn't laughing at this point. All right, we're going to do the major.
Karen O. When we signed the deal to Interscope, I was just thinking, out of all the majors, we chose the one that has Marilyn Manson, Eminem, and Dr. Dre.
Asif Ahmed. They liked Interscope because Interscope was the most flexible. I didn't like Jimmy Iovine too much. I still don't like Jimmy Iovine too much, but I respected him. Nick Zinner. We went with Interscope because they were like, we like what you're doing fine. We wouldn't want to touch a thing. We were like, we want that in writing. Asif Ahmed. Nick was really, really guarded for the first year. He didn't let me do anything, understandably. He got friends that were in the same boat as he, the fresh new band, and then got fucked.
Karen O. I remember thinking they were a little bit more confrontational as a major label.
Nick Zinner. At the very beginning, we wanted to reach kids, teenagers. That is the time when music is the thing that you identify with, and identifies you, and shapes your soul and your future self.
Karen O. The most basic thing that I wanted was to break out of the sort of indie bubble and be able to reach more people instead of being stuck in the indie world. All that changed later. Adele's on an indie label, XL. But at the time, it was like, either you stay at the indies and you never really break out, or you make the leap and try to get the word out.
Nick Zinner. It was about creative freedom, about being able to, at least at the time, work on other projects, and have that not be a big deal.
Karen O. We wanted to give back from what we took. I wanted to see if we could broaden our audience. I can't even remember how the money thing came into play. Our management kind of took the lead on that.
Nick Zinner. We got away with murder. Rob Sheffield. Labor Day weekend 2002. There was an all-day festival under the Williamsburg Bridge in the parking lot. It was a Todd P. show. Yeah Yeah Yeahs headlined. The Liars played. The Roger Sisters. It was an all-day thing. And it was the kind of thing where people were climbing on nearby buildings and jumping on cars to get a look. This is when people still complained about coming out to Brooklyn. It was exciting that this was happening, and so many of my bands were playing at the same time. It was Labor Day, so the trains weren't running that often. So anybody who was there walked there. I remember being really excited and hoping there would be some other fans there. Yaya Yaz went on last, and they were the best. I'd seen them before, but it was the best I had seen them at that point. They played Our Time, and everyone is singing Our Time. And it really did feel like Our Time. It was this parking lot full of people that the song was for. Dave Siddick. New York had literally blown up, and Karen singing It's the Year to Be Hated. That was like the most potent statement ever, and it came from a band playing punk songs for kids. You had all these other high, intellectual-minded people not addressing it at all. And we were just like, whoa, Karen distilled it to like its most essential element, and made it a pop song. And who thought that was going to fucking happen? Rob Sheffield. It would have seemed really weird to think that people were going to start caring about that song all over the world. Chapter 41 House of Jealous Lovers. James Murphy. Luke was going to be my rock star, and then he bailed. Luke Jenner. James abandoned me. It was really hard for me to get over James being an artist because he was supposed to take care of me, and James didn't want to take care of me. The same thing I needed in my wife, I needed in James. But James needed to go be James. Dominique Keegan. Basically, House of Jealous Lovers happened, and that springboarded everything else. Luke Jenner. The classic rock thing was all about the album. To make the definitive statement, like Blonde on Blonde. Rock is an album genre. A lot of post-punk is about this entire record sucks and maybe your entire career sucks, but you have this one awesome song. Andy Greenwald. That one awesome song finally came out in the spring of 2002. Rob Sheffield. It was dance music that attracted a rock audience. The way it combined those two things was really startling. Jason Gordon. It took forever to come out as a proper single, which was frustrating as they had been playing it live along with a few other tracks from Echoes for more than a year. But it was so good. I'd even gotten a hold of a copy of House of Jealous Lovers that had a different and longer intro than the studio LP version. I'd spin that bootleg version, and it always got a massive response. People would freak the fuck out. Rob Sheffield. That was a song that everybody liked, and it was funny because it was hard to find in New York for a long time, back when records were objects and they sold out. Every copy in New York was sold out, and every listener wanted to hear it. It was punk rock that's not pretentious, and dance music that's not pretentious, and like, not like compromising on either end. It's very aggressive on both fronts. That song was such a total soundtrack to that entire year. Mark Ronson. As a DJ, I had to go and buy that 12-inch the minute I heard it. Luke Jenner. House of Jealous Lovers is DFA record number one. They got Morgan Geis to remix it because he was a legitimate house music guy. And they were like, if we get this guy to remix our song, dance music stores will carry this record. They're smart. James Murphy. The Rapture was the coolest band on the planet for a couple of years. The most dangerous. Thomas Honorato. So tight, so talented. They could all sing. And you could dance to the whole show. They are one of the best live bands I ever saw. Luke Jenner. My first fear when House of Jealous Lovers was successful was that it was going to go away. I would just lay awake in a cold sweat for a year just thinking, it's gonna fucking disappear. It's gonna be over. And obviously at some point it didn't, and I started making money. Dominique Keegan. That 12-inch did really well, launched DFA, really. And the British press, like always, was waiting for the next big thing, so they jumped on it big time. Luke Jenner. I knew from watching Don't Look Back and every episode of Behind the Music and reading every rock book that that's how you get famous. You go to England. That's part of the paradigm. So I was obsessed with that. When we were talking to Sub Pop, I was like, you need to get me to fucking England. They were like, you need to tour the U.S. We would just sit there at DFA. And they had ID Magazine, and it had this two-page spread on post-punk. And it had all these New York bands, and they were like, people are going to be stoked on you. You actually get to go to England. That was the plan. Make House of Jealous Lovers go to England, which worked, by the way. Andy Weatherall played it, who's like this really important guy in England. And we all watched that on the internet in the DFA offices. And we were just like, we fucking did it. We did it. Simon Reynolds. Andy Weatherall is key. He had been through post-punk, had been through lots of scenes. And then he became a DJ and a producer and worked with Primal Scream. He was sort of a gateway figure for this rock indie side of things, and the dance thing. He was one of the people who paved the way for DFA. Luke Jenner. Now people think of us as a Brooklyn band, but for a long time people thought we were English. Dominique Keegan. The Rapture just went for it, and it was deserved. That song was such a breath of fresh air in what was such a stale dance music scene. House music had become really boring. Luke Jenner. House of Jealous Lovers not only galvanized indie rock, but it totally galvanized dance music. Straight up. I mean real dance music. I met Felix de Housecat, an old school dance music guy, and he came into Plant Bar at 4 a.m. with a George Clinton-style crew of 10 weirdos, all pretty drunk, and said to me, are you the kid who made House of Jealous Lovers? And I told him I was. I was still working the bar, and he looked at me and said, you're never gonna have to work again. You're set for life. That song is awesome. Good job. Tyler Brody. Out of the Races and Onto the Tracks had gotten them out of the Sub Pop deal. And James and Tim were recording their first record, Echoes, but it took a while. And they weren't formally signed to DFA yet. Jonathan Galkin. Tyler has a weird side, because he was the guy who would just get in the van with the Rapture and just fucking disappear for 2 months. He would go to France, and he would lose his shoes and walk around with no shoes. Tyler Brody. It was great. Basically, they knew I filmed stuff. And we got along great, and we were good friends. They asked me to come on tour and film, and then I just stayed for a while. We started in like a $200 van that would break down all the time. Sleeping in very confusing situations, asking if anyone had a place we could stay at the end of the show. The worst was Washington, D.C., in the middle of the summer, and there was only one air-conditioned room. I was in the vestibule, where every time someone opened the door, it hit me in the head. Even later, when I would spring for hotel rooms, I always got stuck sharing with Luke, and Luke snored really bad. This was all before cell phones. I got the first cell phone for the band, and we used it for years. 10 years later, that cell phone would get calls for the Rapture. Hey, Luke needs to be in a movie. Can you get a message to him for us? We became really good friends. But then it slowly evolved, and they got managers. Tim Goldsworthy. That's when the Rapture got Asif as their manager. So the Rapture went from living in a van to seeing the people getting signed for millions, and realizing that they have probably a better LP than anybody around. Asif Ahmed. I had them, Liars, Yeah Yeah Yeahs, TV on the Radio, The Prosaics. I had a lot of bands. At the same time. And I was going crazy. James Murphy. Asif. Yes, I wanted to break his jaw. Sarush Alvi. Asif wanted to ruin everyone else, and then he ruined himself. That was a whole other thing. James Murphy. He was a know-it-all, and he didn't know what he was talking about. Asif was the deal-maker. Asif Ahmed. James considered me public enemy number one. He thought I poisoned the well against him. And the thing is, I didn't do any of that. I remember having meetings with him, talking about his childhood, whatever. We actually got along really well. I said, what would it take to make this a more agreeable situation for one and all? Because he was definitely a very ego-driven, ambitious person. I mean, mind you, Luke was a very ambitious person too. Maddie was incredibly ambitious. But what's-his-nuts, James Murphy, was very... He was, like, King HNIC. No one is fucking with him. Tyler Brody. The conflict was over the Echoes album. James Murphy. The plan was they would have stayed with us. EMI wanted to make a deal with DFA. I wanted to protect them, so I wanted them to go with us to EMI. Tim Goldsworthy. We were getting the deal with EMI together, and we could have taken the Rapture with us to EMI, but they didn't want to come. Jonathan Galkin. It was around this time that David Holmes actually came back around, because he had started his own record label in England. This was after we put out House of Jealous Lovers. He showed his face, and it was with the intention of hearing this new music we had been working on, so maybe his new label, being funded by Universal UK, could sign it. There was a very dramatic day here, with James hiding the tapes. This is the only time James has almost hit me. I said, everything is fine. David Holmes is not going to sign the Rapture. I'm telling you, it will never happen. I would never let that happen. We've come too far. Because this is when, like, there were starting to be little bidding war type things. Asif Ahmed. The record was already in the can, and there was just this concurrent initiative to sign the label up to a bigger distribution kind of imprint, with EMI. And then we were talking to Universal. I was talking to Mercury. James hated Richard O'Donovan and hated Gary Gersh. I remember this super fucking fancy label dinner with Lucian Grange, Lior Cohen, and Gary Gersh. I mean, it was like everybody. This whole thing was all purely about money. Tyler Brody. When I was out on tour with The Rapture, they were not really signed to us yet. I didn't know that. But the worst part was they didn't know I had anything to do with DFA. We toured for a while, and one day, we're really trying to finally sign them, and James and Tim are like, you've got to come into the lawyer's office with us to convince them, because you're such great friends with them. So I do. And it was just the lawyers battling, and it was terrible. I didn't really say much. The next day, we go back on the road. We went to Massachusetts, and the band asks, what were you doing in the lawyer meeting yesterday? And I said, what do you mean? I own part of the company. I mean, they would talk shit about what James and Tim were trying to do, or about how the negotiations were going, but I just assumed they trusted me enough not to say anything. Jonathan Galkin. They never even asked who Tyler was, which is so perfect. He was just some guy from the building that they knew. That really sums it up. No one is asking questions in the room. Tyler was the guy paying all the bills. Tyler Brody. I still wanted them on the label. That was probably the only time I really put my foot down. I mean, I'd been on the road with them for a year. Vito Roccaforte. The idea was we were going to be on DFA. That was what we wanted to do, and then, you know, all of a sudden we weren't going to be. Asif Ahmed. It was a whole deal with Universal out of the UK, because they had to override James Murphy. The Rapture had to buy out the masters from James. Not to sell state secrets, but it was a pretty healthy deal. Vito Roccaforte. We had a falling out with DFA over the signing to a major label. We wanted to sign with them. We kept getting these crazy offers and we were split as a band internally on what we wanted to do. Asif Ahmed. Vito and Gabe, and I think Maddie, all wanted to stay with DFA. Well, Maddie wanted just the opposite of whatever Luke wanted. Like if Luke said, I think we should all have falafels, Maddie's like, I'm never eating Middle Eastern again. They would just be contrarians for the sake of being contrarians. To my memory, it seemed as though everybody but Luke wanted to stay. I think Luke wanted to go because he wanted money. He said that since he wasn't getting along with people, he might as well make money. Vito Roccaforte. Everything took off so quickly. There was no distribution deal, and we were sitting on this album Echoes with all this crazy amount of hype over House of Jealous Lovers. We had every major label taking us out, putting us up in hotels, buying us dinners that cost more than my rent. It was right at the end of the era when labels would do that. They saw the writing on the wall, but they were still spending money like they did in their heyday. Everybody wanted to make sure they didn't miss out on the next strokes. But if you really took a step away, it's like, really? I really like Echoes, but we were a pretty raw band. James Murphy. I was worried about them psychologically, and about them getting screwed and people talking in their ears. We met all these labels and I fucking hated the Mercury people, and got into this tearful argument with the guy who ran Universal. They're like, we have the biggest market share, we know what we're doing. But I was like, what do you know about this band? If they don't work immediately, you're going to ignore them. Which is what happened. Rob Sheffield. It took so long for the album to come out. It sat around for a year. By the time it came out, everyone was sick of Echoes. Asif Ahmed. The number, by the way, soup to nuts, for the Rapture's Universal deal was $1.8 million. For four records, but I think only two options were picked up. I think they did three records. I sold them off. I gave them to Paul McGuinness right after that deal. I was so stressed out. Rob Sheffield. The rest of the Rapture songs are unknown. Tim Goldsworthy. That was very sad. Stupid fucking idiots for doing it, really. They broke a lot of people's hearts, and they ended up destroying themselves, because they made shit records after that. The ego just got totally out of control. Sarush Alvi. Money changes everything. Tim Goldsworthy. James and I were basically additional members of the band. We tried to explain it to them. They got signed for $1.5 million for that LP. And once you get this cutout, that cutout, you're going to be comfortable for a year. It's not life-changing. And you're going to throw it away. But people like Jimmy Iovine and what's his name, Cohen, Lior Cohen, the Def Jam guy, seeing them work a band is fucking amazing. It's like David Blaine. How they work people is an art form. Especially with somebody damaged. They just do and say all the right things. Vito Roccaforte. I enjoy dinners to a point. Nothing is ever free. Luke Jenner. Signing your life and your artistic well-being away to someone who doesn't like music is not a good idea. I spent the next 5 years in meetings with people who didn't like music, trying to tell them about Acid House. And in college, I liked Dave Matthews Band. I don't really buy music anymore, but I had an internship at college radio, and now I work here and have your band in my hands. That's not a good feeling. Tim Goldsworthy. James is a very aggressive person, and he turned the Rapture betrayal into a kind of anger. I went along with it, which wasn't my nature, and I really regret that. We were partners at the time, and I was like, yeah, I trust this guy, and if that is where we're going to go, we're going there. James's parents had died around this time, and a combination of that, him inheriting a lot of money, seeing Fisher Spooner and shit bands make lots of money, David Holmes, all of that had a huge effect on him. It became, I've got the plan. He was going to fuck the Rapture over. He was going to be bigger than them, and he was going to get a bigger advance, and he was going to destroy them. He's a bully, without a doubt. Psychologically aggressive. 3 days of therapy a week for 20 years gives you serious weapons. Dominique Keegan. James was also going through a hard thing at the time. Both his parents died that year. James Murphy. My parents died in 2001. My mom died in April, and my dad died in August. And when the towers came down, I was pretty blasé about it. To me, it felt really normal. Well, my dad's dead. The person that held the world together while I was a crazy person is gone. Dominique Keegan. He was sleeping on the couch at the DFA office. Tyler Brody. He had a roommate who got married, and he was like, I can't live with my roommate and his wife, that's too much. He didn't have a place, and I guess he had broken up with his girlfriend, who had a place. But he said it motivated him. Every morning people would come into work, and he would have to deflate the air mattress. Dominique Keegan. He was stone cold broke. And then suddenly he was on the cover of NME, and we were partying our fucking asses off. There was a lot of cocaine around, alcohol was always there, and weed was always there. And then we had this friend who introduced us to Quaaludes, which was just the best thing we'd ever done. James Murphy. That was kind of a lonely period. But something really radical happened. It broke me free in a way. Every day I thought, I'm going to die. Losing my edge and the next wave of energy in combat was really driven out of that. Luke Jenner. James is a fighter. Literally. He was into ultimate fighting and his dad was a really good football player. James Murphy. Luke was the star. The whole story was them and us. The Rapture and DFA. And I'm their sound guy. So when they left, we were like, what the fuck are we going to do? EMI were going to make the deal with us, with DFA anyway. But without the Rapture, we were like, really? We didn't know what we were going to do next. Tyler Brody. I guess what happened was we signed a deal with the Rapture, and then both of us got bought out. So we made a ton of money. We got $1.5 million, and they got half, and we got half. That was for Echoes. I wish I paid more attention to this stuff, but it wasn't really my concern. As long as people were continuing to make music, it didn't matter. I was like, we'll start with some new band. James Murphy. When the Rapture left, I was so angry and so hurt. Tim and I felt broken. We took a meeting with Britney Spears to do a song. Jonathan Galkin. I begged them to do that. I will totally take the credit or the blame for that. They were not so into collaborating with anyone else. And James, even at that time, was like, I'm not giving someone else my time. And who the fuck is this girl kind of thing? But part of them, at that time, was also kind of curious. I mean, James also took a call from Janet Jackson. I sat right next to him. He put it on speaker. She was like, I love that song, Losing My Edge. It's got a real grit to it. I hope we can work together. He's like, okay. And that was it. Never heard from her again. Anyway, Britney Spears did show up. She had a bodyguard who sat upstairs right outside that door on a folding chair, never moved. She came here with her Starbucks and Marlboro Lights, as you will. Tried one track. Tim had worked out like an instrumental, and she had laid out vocals. And James was down here too. I think he tried to co-write some lyrics or something with her. I have the track. It's good. It's awesome. It sounds somewhere between, like, Liquid Liquid and I Feel Love by Donna Summer. I played it for people. I remember people saying, oh my god, this will be amazing. Tim Goldsworthy. She had the icing off of 2 Magnolia cupcakes and 4 cans of Red Bull, did some really strange ad-lib vocal takes, and then just disappeared and was never heard from again. Jonathan Galkin. It was one of those things that we just didn't really understand. Where pop stars just start little fires at different studios all over the world. And maybe by the end of the album, some A&R guy comes behind them, listening to what happened and saying, that one. That guy came here. It was Jive Records, and I remember him saying, I like it. I gotta tell you, man, it's too hip. Chapter 42. Losing My Edge. James Murphy. My career as a frontman was accidental. Luke Jenner. The whole time we were making Echoes, me and everyone else around him were just like, you need to make your own fucking record because you're domineering. And so he did it. James Murphy. At some point it dawned on me that I had to do it. If I thought it was such a good idea for the Rapture to go with us to EMI, then I had to do it myself. I had to show that I meant it. I thought, if I sit here and complain about how bullshit their leaving is and do nothing, I'm just as guilty. I can play, I can engineer, I can sing and do all the instruments. And if I can't make something good from all that, Then tough shit for me. I went to EMI and said, I have a band now. Jonathan Galkin. They were like, hey, fuck the Rapture, we're still psyched on you guys. EMI eventually imploded and everything went to shit. But they took care of James. They kept us alive. We felt justified because it was like these guys totally could have taken care of the Rapture, too. Dominique Keegan. Beat Connection was the record I adored. Jonathan Galkin. He had Beat Connection by this point. He worked on that one record for maybe 9 months. He had gone up to well over 100 versions of the song. A tempo change, a new bass line. A little something where, like, no one else would notice. But he just couldn't lock it in. That's very much his personality. Luke Jenner. For a year and a half, I had a conversation with James Murphy like, disco's great. And he was like, no, it's not. I like house music, but I don't like disco. James is super methodical, and he puts everything in little boxes. At the time, James also didn't listen to jazz, even though he has an Ornette Coleman tattoo on his shoulder. It says, This Is Our Music, which is from an Ornette Coleman record. But he was afraid to get into it because he was like, I'd just get too obsessive and I wouldn't be able to concentrate. He's like super OCD, so he's really careful what he puts his attention on and exposes himself to. Dominique Keegan. I thought Beat Connection was fucking amazing. 5 minutes of drumming with an arpeggiated synthesizer and then it's the saddest night out in the USA. That was my number one DJ record for 4 years. James Murphy. Beat Connection was what I worked on for a year. Losing my edge was quick. Jonathan Galkin. It sort of came spilling out of him, as he was ranting into this tape recorder, which I think is right by my desk to this day. It was a mini cassette recorder. Tyler Brody. An ex-girlfriend of mine brought Pharrell Williams to this show at Tribeca Grand, and James met Pharrell. That's when he was like, I'm losing my edge to this kid. He was like, this guy knows what's up. I'd better get my shit together. Thomas Honorato. What's that song where he talks about all the influences? Losing My Edge. That song says it all. He's talking about being at the first Cannes show. All these other historic music events, but feeling so old. Feeling eclipsed by those coming up behind you, appropriating all your references. I related to that song so much. Jonathan Galkin. I'm the Internet Seeker. James would say, you've never heard Future Days by Can? And I was like, no, but I just ordered it. And he'd say, Jesus Christ, it took me 15 years to find that record. Not that he wasn't buying vinyl on eBay, but I was just the epitome of never heard it. I'll have it in 2 days, and by the way, now I know everything about the record. Here's where it was recorded, and here's the gear, and here's the lineup, and James... I'd just be reading this off, you know, whatever the version of Wikipedia we had at the time. Andy Greenwald. The thing that makes pop music so great is the way it parallel parks on the bleeding edge of cool. Nothing could be better at this moment than this beat, this feeling, this chorus. It takes something ephemeral and impossible, and for 3 to 4 exhilarating minutes, it makes it accessible and real. Losing My Edge is a song that's already bled out. It sticks its nose in all the parts you're supposed to ignore. Jealousy, resentment, sarcasm, age. But it's not obnoxious in the way funny music often is. The real trick is that it's hitting you while it's heckling you. The song bangs, even if the vocalist is a crank. I still don't quite know how he did it. Most breakthrough singles are about first love. Losing My Edge is about first loss, and the second, and the third, and etc., etc., until everyone is just a jaded music critic in the bar right after the ugly light switches on. And you're dancing too much to care. Dominique Keegan. The beat from Losing My Edge came from a present Ad Rock gave James. It was a ghetto blaster with a synthesizer on the top of it. James Murphy. Adam Horovitz gave me a beatbox that he bought at a garage sale on the way home from a furniture buying trip. I said I want to make a song with just this. Dominique Keegan. James locked himself in the studio. He wanted to do all his writing and recording in the studio overnight on his own. He just pressed record and played live drums over one of the beats on that synthesizer. James Murphy. I had the song in my head all the time. Jonathan Galkin. I was there when James Murphy played Losing My Edge for the first time. I thought it was terrible. In hindsight, how did I not get it? But James was a slightly unhinged character at that time, so hearing that scared me, like maybe he's really coming unglued. Marcus Lamkin. I remember the first time I heard that song. I remember James bringing me downstairs. Hey, we did this thing, you know? What do you think? It was just, holy shit, that's fucking amazing. Tim Goldsworthy. Do I like that track? No, I hate it, to be honest, because I know the things that are being ripped off. Losing My Edge is a direct rip-off of a Killing Joke track. Directly. I hate it because it devalued those tracks. Tracks which I love, I can't listen to anymore. James Murphy. I'd inherited a little money when my parents died, and I took an apartment. I made the 12 inches and put the band together, and went on tour a little bit. We played a few festivals. I was so aggressive. I felt like I lost a lot, and therefore I had nothing to lose. I had no money, but I remember I had an offer from a publishing company for $350,000, and I was like, no, because it won't change my life. If you have $1 million cash, I'll take it so I can buy an apartment and live like a rich person or the child of a rich person. Then I'd have this apartment, but everything else is cocaine and shoes. I'm just going to develop tastes I can't afford, and I'm going to do a bunch of drugs. So I didn't take it. Tim and John were married and started having kids and stuff. I'm the scary one. I'm the one who doesn't care. I'm the one who counts down to death. But I rented that apartment. I went to a farm studio and I recorded the first record. I paid for it. And when it was done, I played it for EMI. Jonathan Galkin. The EMI deal was for LCD, and for the label DFA Records. Separate deals. LCD was signed for a more traditional album deal. And then the label deal was more of a first-look deal. Even though they ended up saying yes to everything, which in hindsight was totally wrong. I wish they said no more, and then we were just allowed to release it through other means. They were like, yeah, we'll put on Black Dice. And even if it sells 5,000 or 10,000 copies worldwide, for us doing it ourselves, we'd be like, cool, we sold 10,000 copies of a completely insane record. But for them, it was, it's a total failure and that's dropped. Everything we did wound up being one and done. James Murphy. I had a revelation that it was easier than I thought. I was afraid and suddenly became unafraid. Was that the beginning of LCD? Yeah. The combination of David Holmes leaving, The Rapture leaving, working on Beat Connection, and Tim saying the drums sounded really good. Jonathan Galkin. The first LCD 12-inch was Beat Connection and Losing My Edge. Rob Sheffield. I still remember Justine playing Losing My Edge for the first time. This would have been the summer of 2002. It was 3 in the morning at Don Hills. I had no idea what it was and had to Google it the next day. That happened a lot at 3 in the morning at Don Hills. I'm jotting down lyrics and there's maybe a dozen people left in the bar, and they're all just trying to buy drugs, so anytime you go to the bathroom, 3 people would follow you. I'd be like, sorry, dude, I think the kitchen is closed. I was already a big fan of James Murphy's productions and his DJing, but I had never heard his voice before, and I was like, holy shit. I was like, who is this? What the fuck song is this? Because he was literally describing the room I was standing in. So he was describing everybody's Saturday night. Who are all these Brooklynites in their little jackets and borrowed nostalgia for the unremembered 80s? There was a fuckload of that to see. Mark Ronson. Losing My Edge, I dug, but it was almost too clever for me. Mark Spitz. Jason Roth from Spin came in and said, "You have to hear this." He played Losing My Edge. This is before it was released. It was like a bootleg or something that was going around. The first thing was this sense of excitement, like, wow. He's mentioning all these reference points that are like insider name checks. And then it sunk in. Oh. Oh no, this is not good. Once the sort of elation wore off, you realized that he was taking the piss. And there was no being a rock snob again after that song. It's kind of like what Kiss or the guys from Iron Maiden must have felt like when they first watched Spinal Tap. James Murphy reduced rock snobs like myself and himself to an utter cliche in 8 minutes. Moby. LCD was always funny. James is very talented. They made some very good records, but it's interesting because it's almost music as journalism. It's like the songs describe things that have happened. Like Daft Punk is playing at my house. That's journalism. And Losing My Edge. It's hard to say this without sounding a little petulant, but almost everything he mentioned in the song, I was there. James Endicott. All those early DFA records, everybody was just desperate to get them. They were super cool here in London. You were in the know if you knew those records. And Losing My Edge? That song is so prophetic. Now any hipster kid is like, I was there when LCD Sound System played their last show. Or I was there when the Strokes did this or that.
Trisha Romano. I didn't buy James Murphy as a rock star. James was so funny and so nice, and I really liked him, but I just didn't really want to watch him sing songs. To me, he wasn't a rock star, and they didn't make dance music. Johanna Fateman. I didn't really get it. I guess I wasn't acquainted with who James was lampooning in that song. And it also didn't go with his personality, because he wasn't cynical or jaded. My impression of James was just this big teddy bear that was just excited about everything. But, I mean, I thought it was good. We were happy for him. Trisha Romano. But I will say that Losing My Edge was pure brilliance because it was totally applicable both to dance music and to jaded rock and rollers. I used to make fun of Frank Owen from The Voice. He seemed so much older to me when I was 20. But he liked to come into the office and brag about going to Paradise Garage. And I'd be like, in my mock obnoxious British accent, "Back in the day, we used to craft our own disco ball, and we used to walk 5 miles in the snow to get to the gig." Losing My Edge was a send-up of that guy. Everybody knew that guy. And that fucking beat is filthy. You can't get enough of that beat. That and House of Jealous Lovers were the only rock-slash-dance records that really penetrated. And those two records really did help merge those two scenes, where the rock stars would DJ at the dance parties and the dance kids would actually tolerate them.
Rob Sheffield. James Murphy wasn't an emaciated teenage boy in a mod suit and skinny tie that he bought last week. James Murphy. I knew Nick, and I'd seen Yeah Yeah Yeahs play at the Parkside, and I really liked it. And I loved the Strokes. But I wasn't immersed in it. They were not in our world. We were making our world. Rob Sheffield. He gave a very interesting interview to Mojo around the time This Is Happening came out about body image. He was like, I liked all this music that only skinny boys liked, and I always felt not skinny enough. I was really surprised that he said it, because nobody says stuff like that. He was there with his stubble and his hair, but he was also totally serious. And it was really interesting. Andy Greenwald. I interviewed James with Tim at the DFA headquarters in 2003. In the interview, Tim was smart and quiet, and James was hilarious and loud. He was a rock star on the tape recorder long before he picked up a microphone. What I remember best was how skilled he was at using his age as a weapon instead of a shield. Sure, he was very self-effacing about how long he'd been in the business. He talked a lot about his time working with Six Finger Satellite, and all these other indie bands that seemed positively ancient to me, even then. But instead of being hemmed in by his experience, he was liberated by it. He'd stood around, bored, tapping his feet at punk shows for so long, the idea of doing blow and dancing until dawn wasn't absurd. It was absurdly appealing. I was the young guy writing a story about the new cool scene. But this joker in the XL t-shirt was running laps around me. Because unlike all the other bands I was writing about, he didn't give a shit about where he lived, what he wore, or how he lived. It wasn't a pose for him. It was fun. That gave him power. I think when losing my edge hit, he finally realized how much of it he had. James Murphy. Did I want what happened next to happen? I didn't think I was going to take up so much time. The band really was kind of a lark. I'll make a record. We'll do a little touring. I didn't know you could tour with demand. You could just keep getting invited to play good things. I remember I went to Pianos once around that time after losing my edge. And there was a guy I didn't know at the door. And the guy was like, oh, no problem, James. Come right in. And I was like, what? Chapter 43. Maps.
Karen O. You can liken it to the young men that fight a war and have these extreme experiences and come back just utterly bonded to the people that were with them. You forge these friendships because it is such an extreme lifestyle, being in a rock band and touring the world, especially when you're doing it when you're really young and you don't have much control over your life. Everything just feels out of control all the time. The other metaphor I see is there's a Western where there's some guy who gets knocked off his horse, but his foot is still on the stirrup, and he's just being dragged by this fucking Mustang or something. That's how it feels to be in a successful rock band in New York.
Mark Spitz. They were about to release the Fever to Tell record, and everyone felt like it was going to be an important record. She was regarded as the new PJ Harvey, and that she was a real rock star. She was thought of as someone who was going to need to be reckoned with.
Karen O. The whole experience was really overwhelming, basically. All of a sudden, we went from there being hype around us to really seeing the effects of it. We were doing these shows in the UK, our first headlining shows over there, and it was just total fanaticism. It was a glimpse into the future, seeing what it might be if we broke in the US. It was overwhelming, and it was hard to process.
David Burton. Karen was a young woman on a meteoric rise, basically going from her bedroom to the boardroom. And she was a very emotional girl. And she also wouldn't take care of herself. She had terrible habits, to the point where even the old roadies didn't eat like she did. But she also had youth on her side. Nick Zinner. We did Fever to Tell ourselves. Asif Ahmed, with Dave Siddick producing. Nick Zinner, we felt a lot of pressure. I think Karen felt most of the pressure. Things were going super, super fast recording this thing. We'd done all the rough basic tracks in like a day or 2 days, and meanwhile we were supposed to play the Reading Festival in 2 weeks. Karen totally put the brakes on and canceled that shit. She was like, this whole thing is spiraling out of control, and we need to get a solid foundation first. Asif Ahmed. Oh yeah, that was a real fun conversation to have. They canceled it 2 weeks before, or maybe a week. I just shit my pants. David Burton. I remember being $10,000 poorer that year, but I understood. I remember sitting in my house in Dublin and then saying, yeah, we're not going on tour. I was packing my bag for the airport. My first question was how I was going to eat that month. Asif Ahmed. They were only playing the BCC Radio 1 stage at Reading. It was in the afternoon, and I think they were only getting £5,000 per show. And then they offered us £15,000. They thought I was playing hardball, and I said, no, she's just not getting on a plane. She's literally going to be in a salon getting her mustache waxed. She's not getting on a plane. I really said that to the promoter.
Karen O. Before we knew it, there were all these other shows being booked, including Reading. I can't remember if we'd even started the record or hadn't finished it, but I definitely felt like I was on the verge of a meltdown. I knew that if we just continued the way we were going, I was going to burn out much too quickly, and that what was more important than pleasing promoters and believing all this hype was to get our record done. The record was more important than dragging ourselves around on the road, and for me, personally, just, like, health-wise.
Nick Zinner. She gets sick really easily. We were always really sick. I used to get bronchitis on every tour. I was also smoking a pack a day.
Karen O. I was at the tipping point, you know?
Nick Zinner. Initially, my reaction was go, 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 go. I'm a Sagittarius. Momentum, movement, traveling, being busy, that's my natural habitat. It's what I like doing best. Whereas once things started to accelerate and get crazy, that's when she first started to buckle. It affected her physically, emotionally, in every single way. She's a Sagittarius Scorpio cusp. So with her, there's this kind of push-pull. John Spencer. We used to call them the maybe, maybe, maybes. That was the joke. Once when we were in England, they came to us in a dressing room and said, somebody had a cold or something, and said, would it be okay if we didn't play tonight? I didn't know what to say. How do you respond to this? I think I may have said, well, yes, I don't care. It just seemed so weird that they were asking permission, and I couldn't believe that they would even do that. When we started with Pussy Galore, it was always incredibly hard early on, and a lot of it was just miserable. But you got to play. You know, no money, terrible food, sleeping on people's floors, playing the worst shitholes around. You could feel like crap, but you'd still play. So that was a little weird, but also cute, I guess. Asif Ahmed. You know what? She wasn't dramatic. She was overwhelmed. I don't think any of them had any expectations of where the whole Yeah Yeah Yeahs thing would go. The most ambitious one at the time was Nick, just because he'd been at it for a long time. He is considerably older than the other two.
Karen O. I had to demand it, too, because the idea of canceling shows at that point was frightening for everybody. Everyone thinks, you're going to piss the promoters off. You're going to piss the fans off. It's so taboo.
David Burton. A lot of it had to be anxiety. Also, she wouldn't have been warming up properly, so I can only imagine what shape her throat was in. You're like, man, do you not know what fucking tea is? You can do as much coke as you want, but you've got to buy a box of throat coat tea. I'm sure the label was pretty upset. Fans weren't happy because there'd been a lot of cancellations already in their career.
Karen O. But I just felt if we didn't go that route, it was going to end up badly.
Jaleel Bunton. I watched what happened with Yeah Yeah Yeahs. I was living with them when the first little Rolling Stone thing came out, around the first EP. I remember this girl riding her bike down the street in Brooklyn one day just screaming, Yeah Yeah Yeahs are playing! They didn't control that. Once they signed, there was a groundswell. They're great, they're good friends of mine, and I think they're an amazing band. But you have no control. I'm in this thing that's happening. I'm in the center of this thing. Angus Andrew. What felt private for a while, or felt like we were working in our own space, started to feel a bit claustrophobic. Jaleel Bunton. The thing I realized from watching Yeah Yeah Yeahs is that it happens outside of you. Before I knew them, I'd see their posters everywhere, and I'd be like, who the fuck do they think they are? Later, I was getting on the train one day, and there was a poster of us, and I was like, that's not me. That's the thing that they're selling. I didn't put my poster up here. Someone else did that. It happens outside of you. Brian Chase. With Yeah Yeah Yeahs, it does come down to heart. There's always a sense of looking past boundaries or expectations and just staying in touch with a spirit that feels, like, just really excited and pure. David Burton. In hindsight, it's easy to say it was the right call, because it clearly didn't hurt them, They kind of went on to do things their own way. Chris Taylor. Well, then they had that Map single, and it was like, holy shit, they're a real band. Asif Ahmed. That was their signature. Andy Greenwald. That's just a universe slang song. Sarush Alvi. They wrote a hit. Those fucking weird art project kids wrote a beautiful hit and it went global. Nick Zinner. Maps was another big moment when we knew we had something.
Karen O. It was just a love song I wanted everyone to hear, and they heard it.
Asif Ahmed. Nick writes some of the better songs, but Karen did write Maps, 100%.
Karen O. We wrote it in Nick's room with the blue drum machine and a four-track recorder. I was really lovelorn at the time. They Don't Love You Like I Love You was straight from a love letter, and I just plucked it out of there because I thought it had a good ring to it. Just a simple statement that really stuck with people. You know, I say love letter, but it was a fucking email. Motherfucker. You know what? I'm going to rewrite history right here. I wrote it with a quill. It was a feather quill written in blood. It might as well have been.
Jaleel Bunton. I remember when that record came out because Dave produced that record, and they played it for me. That was the first song of theirs that I was like, what are you doing? This is the single for the record. Dave said, no, they don't want to put it out. I'm like, this is insane. I'm the dummy who likes the B-sides, whatever, but this song is the song. It is the fucking song. There's no doubt about it. And that record stalled until that song came out. Asif Ahmed. A full 9 months. I think a full 10 months. The album came out the week of my birthday in the spring of 2003. And then I think Maps hit January or February of 2004. Sarush Alvi. This was Brooklyn proving that it could. It's such a simple, beautiful song. That song is the perfect representation of the idea that stick to the art, stick to making something of quality and it will work. When they made it, they weren't trying to write a hit. They were like, here's a sweet little love song. It's actually a weird song. It's super minimal, lots of empty space. And then Nick's amazing fucking guitar jam at the end. And then they're out.
Karen O. You never know what's gonna hit. You might think, oh, this song or that song, but it's rare that you're actually right. But we knew it from the moment we wrote Maps. The moment it came out, there was just something about that one.
Joe Levy. It's deeply romantic. Deeply romantic in a way that is not at all cynical. And this goes through some sort of current of New York rock. It is in the Velvet Underground. It is in the Ramones. It's in that Yeah 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 song. It's a sentimentality that has to connect through a sense of struggle and grit and fuck you. Asif Ahmed. The thing is, they were willing to wait. Chapter 44. A Thing That Doesn't Work But Does. Brian Chase. When we were growing up, it was really Liars and TV on the Radio that were our mates.
Karen O. Those were our peers.
Dave Siddick. I showed up in late 99, early 2000. I was in Baltimore, where I'm from, and I was in a 10-year relationship. We broke up and I just went nuts. I was like, well, fuck it. If I'm going to live on the edge, I might as well live on the edge with my brother and in New York. So I moved to New York. Tunde Erebimpe. I moved to New York in 1993. Jaleel Bunton. When I lived here first, I was playing with my brother Kareem, and one of my best friends who had come to go to the new school. When we first moved here, our band was called Mudbone, a live hip-hop band. Later we changed and became Pleasure Unit. Paul Banks. I used to go watch Pleasure Unit all the time. I crashed a rehearsal of theirs beneath Max Fish one night. Jaleel was playing bass, but the rumor was he was one of the greatest guitarists in town. Jaleel Bunton. Yeah, Paul was one of our few supporters, and we really appreciated that. Dave Siddick. My brother had been living in a place around the corner from where Nick, Angus, Aaron, and Karen all lived, on Metropolitan. There was